there's upstairs that will heal and repair. No one can compare. They stare and they stare. I'm aware, head up, no glare. I'm in the light, I'm in the fight, I'm in the sight. I'm out of the gate and I'm feeling it out. I'm out of the gate and I'm making a sound. I'm out of the gate and I know what's about. I'm out of the gate and I'm doing it loud. I'm out of the gate and I'm feeling it out. I'm out of the gate and I'm making a sound. I'm out of the gate and I know what it's about. I'm out of the gate and I'm doing it loud. I'ma speak and speak to my highest peak. I'ma seek and seek till it becomes a technique.
Good evening. Yeah, good evening. good evening. You're listening to the Indigenous Collective here at CITR. The Indigenous Collective broadcasts from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. We're back again this week. My name is Sage. I'm mixed European ancestry with Sawridge Cree from Alberta, and I'm excited to be joined with a new crew tonight, so I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Shelby. I am Anishinaabe and Mohawk from the Bekejunong First Nation.
Sego sewa gogo shinia nyontesa sundayago yonjats kanegaga tanomaya nongonsota kanawagi netwagen on unceded Coast Salish territory ganagere. My name is Shinia. I am Mohawk from Ganawagi and Maya from Guatemala, but I live here and grew up here in the unceded Coast Salish territory.
Tunse, my name is Sabrina Mashenko. I am Plains Cree from Treaty 4 territory in eastern Saskatchewan.
Hi, good evening. My name is Emily Henderson, and I am Inuk and European. And my family comes from the British Isles and Greenland, but I have lived most of my life in British Columbia.
So that's our crew tonight. We're excited to bring you a whole host of new topics. So we're pretty excited tonight to be talking about, like I say, a lot of things, but we're going to start it off with Emily. We're really grateful to have Inuk and Inuk person here, able to speak on some current events. So she's going to open it up, open up the conversation.
First thing I'd like to say is happy International Inuit Day. So November 7th is International Inuit Day. So I've been celebrating with all my friends. And I would like to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about something that's been kind of a major conversation in sort of the broader Inuit community, and that is a recent New York Times article by an author by the name of Catherine Porter that ran on October 20th, titled Drawn from Poverty, Art Was Supposed to Save Canada's Inuit, It Hasn't. Porter went on to publish a second article titled Art Emerges from Difficulty in Canada's North on October 25th. And these are all articles that are based on, I think, three separate trips that she took to the hamlet of Cape Dorset in Nunavut, Canada. So something I'd like to draw attention to is, first of all, like the title of this article. People, you might be noticed, drawn from poverty. So that's a play on words, obviously, about the art that Cape Dorset is known for, colored pencil drawing, prints. But it doesn't make any allusion to drawing from resilience or strength or hope or tradition. It is very much implied that the artistic practice of this community is coming out of this sort of impoverished place, and it sort of riffs off these different stereotypes about the North and Inuit people. And then again to the word saved in the title. And it's also worth noting that this is not a one-off from the New York Times, which is a major publication with millions of readers both in print and online each day. So past titles have been about the way that Inuit are struggling in their self-rule or the way that we're losing territories and traditions. A quick Google search of New York Times Inuit like will bring up past hits from the archive with these similar sort of themes of the disappearance or vanishing of the impoverished Inuit. This particular story has been slammed by artists such as Alethea Arnakuk-Brill and Tanya Taga as poverty and trauma porn that are harmful to the community, in which Catherine Porter was invited into homes. And many of these people that she interviewed and profile are now expressing their regret in inviting her in that way. And paints many of the people she portrays, especially artist Lucy Sila, who's a current up-and-comer in the Inuit art world, as just being people that have fallen prey to substance abuse, poverty, and violence, and not really necessarily celebrating them for their achievements or celebrating the artistic forms. So despite a call from the Native American Journalists Association for an audit of the article, there has not been any meaningful response either from the Times or from Ms. Porter herself. And I don't want to dwell on this sort of negatives of the issue. This is not something that is a first time that we've never seen before. And but I think that a lot of what stems from this is conversations about allyship, media representation, and contemporary Indigenous issues such as Indigenous agency that we're going to be discussing and breaking down for you this evening. And later after the break, I'm really excited to explore a little bit more about possible solutions for Indigenous-driven media representation going forward in the future.
So a topic that Emily has touched on in that incredible expose is that we've talked about here before is allyship. We're gonna be discussing the theme of allyship throughout tonight's show. But before we dive into this topic specifically and allyship in general, we are going to hear a little ad.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Now, did I just sneak in a secondary land acknowledgement? Absolutely. Yeah, I did. all right, so we're going to open up the conversation. We've talked about allyship before. We get to talk about it in relation to Inuit people and art representation. But before we jump into it, Sabrina is going to run us down on what allyship and consensual allyship is.
Yeah, we did talk about this in the past and kind of this concept of consensual allyship and what that really means. And I find so often in narratives led by non-Indigenous people, it's kind of allyship becomes this topic that is very much centered around the ally rather than the actual people themselves. So consensual allyship is kind of acknowledging the space that you're in and whether your allyship and your actions are needed and whether they are respectful to the people that you are trying to help. Because so often without acknowledging that, you can actually cause more harm than good in, you know, in this journey of trying to do betterment.
Does anyone have any immediate thoughts about allyship when it comes to this, the sort of representation issue of this New York Times article?
I mean, just jumping right off the gun, especially because this topic of consensual allyship and even listening to this article, this isn't an uncommon tale I find in a lot of Indigenous, articles. So often just going forward, we find that a lot of people, they're like, look at all of this information that I've found that I'm going to bring and put out into this news article without actually thinking about the effects that that can have and the narrative it can tell about the community that they're so supposedly trying to help.
Yeah, just jumping off of that particular article that I discussed earlier was that there's an example in the article where she describes the beautiful Bita de Mounty, which is a woman's parka that is owned by Miss Sila, who's the artist that's predominantly profiled through the article. And she said, and it's beautiful. You would never known that it was tossed in a garbage bag as she was fleeing her abusive relative, right? So yeah, that sort of representation.
Yeah, it's that kind of overall romanticizing of damage scented narratives and especially trying to find make it sound like it's something positive, or I guess to them it adds grit and it adds a hurtful reality into a story, but it really isn't doing anything for the community itself.
Just to that, I find a lot of these people who like to call themselves allies really do this trauma play. That's how they sell the stories. Yeah. And that's not what we're about, Our stories are so much more than the trauma.
And it definitely plays off of those stereotypes of what we see as the Indigenous community. It plays off the idea that Indigenous people as like a collective, obviously, you know, to say Indigenous people of Canada is to umbrella a very diverse amount of people, but to just that kind of pre-bias people have when looking at Indigenous people and like what they see as the Indigenous community as something that is beaten down and on like the edge of like no return, this is a dying community, and like stuff like this that really frames that and highlights that rather than like the beauty in itself. Like, this is an article that was really highlighting Inuk art, and like it could have, had it been actually focused on the art itself and didn't, you know, pepper in all of this like slurs of like just this is a community, like talking about, you know, substance abuse, talking about like the poverty and like the low income housing, it would have been actually a awesome article that could have, it had had so much potential that was thrown away just to feed into that kind of bias that people have.
Yeah, I think it's pretty unfortunate that like that sort of narrative is juxtaposed to art, like this thing that is like inherently like tied to resurgence, tied to expression, tied to culture. Like, you can't argue that it isn't like healing and like an expression of like positive and powerful things coming out of a community. And it takes such effort to break that down and then like condense it into such a small headline that really like tears it to pieces. It's so frustrating. And I think it really speaks to like how hard sometimes you have to try, and like the we're giving up on that. Cognitive dissonance, there we go. That people really like, they just want to feed into that narrative, that like really sexy survivor narrative that they're helping. Yeah. And they completely overlook like incredible efforts and like powerful freaking efforts.
Yeah, you know, let's make our let's, what I'm trying to say, it's late. We're trying to make healing the new sexy, you know? Let's throw aside that trauma.
True. Which we will absolutely get to in the second half of our show. If you don't know, we are going to have a conversation tonight that brings up a lot of topics, a lot of themes. We're going to talk about it the way that it is. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about it the way that it could be. Our theme this year is Indigenous Futurisms. So we're going to get to that shortly. But on the topic of allyship, and I think sort of what we've already discussed is how allyship can be performative. And it can be sort of like surface level, and that plays in at all different levels. So we sort of talked about it in terms of representation in media and sort of like others speaking for Indigenous communities. We're gonna have a conversation after a short break on UNDRIP. We're gonna take it global, baby, and we're gonna talk about UNDRIP and BC's efforts to implement it. But like I say, right before that, we're just going to hear another quick ad.
Do you love podcasts? Do you wish you had the skills to make one? The Vancouver Podcast Festival returns this November 7th to 10th with some of the most popular podcasts from across Canada and around the world. You'll be able to meet the creators and voices behind hit shows like Dirty John, Thunder Bay, The Illusionist, The Secret Life of Canada, Red Man Laughing, and Dark Poutine. You can also sign up for masterclasses to learn from podcasting experts, attend free panels and live recordings at the VPL, or visit Podfair to participate in a meetup, grab a coffee, and converse with fellow podcasters and fans. For more information about tickets and student discounts, visit vanpodfest.ca.
That sounds good.
All right, welcome back. So like I said, I'm going to orient you a little bit. We're coming back, and geography-wise, we're going to be in British Columbia, but we're talking about UNDRIP, which is the UN Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And Sabrina is going to open us up with a little bit of background.
Yeah, definitely jumping into like UNDRIP, and just for like some context for listeners who may be a little less fluent on what UNDRIP is, I know Sage was lovely, but it is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and it was developed back in 2007 to protect the rights of Indigenous peoples kind of globally. Now, when this was this concept was, you know, first introduced, it was kind of like unanimously, like 140 countries were like, yeah, this is like a good direction to start going. But there was four countries who voted against it. And if anyone wants to take a guess, it's the four countries that share a very similar colonial history. So we have Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand were very much against this. They did come around a little bit and they did change their stance on this. But like, even looking at where this is in the future, there really hasn't been any concrete change within these four countries in regards to implementing UNDRIP. But, you know, skipping to the end of October, we did have a little bit of a move, I'll say the move in a right direction in regards to BC, British Columbia here in Canada. They're actually moving to implement the UN Declaration in a way that we really haven't seen before. Of course, UNDRIP has always been, you know, a relevant topic globally, but back in 2016, there was a move to try to have a bill brought into legislation to make sure Canadian laws aligned with UNDRIP, but that bill died earlier this year when it was held up in Senate. And there is still talk of UNDRIP being incorporated federally, but this is just talk, which is a very common theme when it comes to Indigenous, you know, issues and topics. But yeah, that's essentially the rundown of UNDRIP. They're really, we had this, you know, wonderful thing of BC really wanting to implement it at a federal level. And I really want to open up the discussion. Is this something that should be handled provincially, or should it be moved to be handled at a more country level? I'm really interested. Does anyone have any thoughts, feelings?
I mean, I find this very interesting because of Canada and the federal system. I mean, you touched on a little bit, like provincial and the federal government, but in Canada, Indigenous peoples and their issues, quote, are handled by the federal government, despite like vast differences culturally and geographically across Canada. And that can be critiqued for any number of reasons. I know there are certain like reasons why it's handled federally. But then there's some talk that like should First Nations peoples, Inuit, Métis, should those issues be issues again? It's like, oh my God, should those topics be handled by provincial governments? So I think it's really interesting that BC is like making a move, especially considering that it's a province in a country that doesn't really support the UNDRIP on a whole.
Another interesting thing to highlight is like British Columbia as a province is mainly on unceded land. You know, this land hasn't been ever formally given up by the Indigenous people on here. And one of the things highlighted in UNDRIP, and I'm going to actually do a direct quote here, is Article 32. And it says, quote, Indigenous peoples have the right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for the development or use of their lands or territories and other resources. States shall consult and cooperate in good faith with Indigenous peoples in order to obtain their free and informed consent prior to the approval of any projects affecting their lands or territories and other resources, end quote. And that is coming directly from UNDRIP. And I think moving forward with the implementation of this in BC, that is something I'd be really interested in seeing and how they want to handle, because so far it's been discussed as something that is, you know, heavy quotations here, but not a veto card, even though in its, you know, bare essentials, it definitely does sound like something that should give priority to Indigenous people over their lands.
Yeah. Horgan, who is the NDP leader and BC premier, and Scott Fraser, the Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation, both said that it was not a veto, which, you know, I mean, is just falls back into this whole performativeness of allyship, because what then is the point of it? You know, self-determination, and especially in BC with all these fights going on around pipelines, what is the point of this? Like, what really is happening? Reconciliation, I don't have a problem with that term in general, but where and how are they actually going to implement this if the veto is not what Indigenous peoples of this unceded territory are allowed to do?
And I think, you know, just thinking about any kind of, like, you brought up performative allyship, and I think that's a very common theme we see here in Canada, especially with, you know, this new development with UNDRIP in BC, because on paper, there really is no set timeline for it. It's just kind of that nature of, like, look at this thing that we're gonna do, but without a timeline or without a deadline, like, who's to say whether that's gonna happen within the next year? Who's to say this is gonna be, like, 10 years? There's really no, like, reins on it.
Yeah, and even to that, you know, what people are the ones that are allowed to kind of, you know, assert their opposition or their issues with whatever projects they're trying to put through? Is it the people who are in power in communities that hold positions that were given and implemented from the federal government? Like, are these people who are still following along with this settler colonial systems of governance? Because if so, how then does that change anything? Because we are not allowed to assert our sovereignty. You know, we're still, it's falling under these, akin to settler colonialism, and really we're just perpetuating what's been happening for 500 years.
Yeah, and, like, I found, like, a lot with this came a lot of talk, like, is this a move towards Indigenous people's right to, like, a self-government? But it's, again, like, if you're implementing, you know, Indigenous people who are, or, like, any kind of, like, person who's speaking on behalf of Indigenous people who are, like, based around the framework of, like, power in a settler colonial society, like, is that really, like, a self-government to Indigenous people, or is it just kind of, like, this, I guess, picture frame sort of way of doing it? Like, that just, again, kind of perpetuates that idea of, like, allyship that's just for show but doesn't really have anything to tell.
True. Some big questions, some big themes. We are going to once again orient ourselves, bringing us closer to the station here tonight. We're actually going to talk about something that's happening in Vancouver, on the unceded Coast Salish lands, as we've already talked about tonight. So moving away from that sort of idea, these big questions of, like, governance and these, like, imposed conventions that don't actually mean anything and don't really go anywhere, we're going to start getting closer to the topic of futurisms. Shelby's going to intro something that's going on in Vancouver right now that's pretty rad. So Shelby, take it away.
Just recently, I think that was this morning, I'm not sure, but the Squamish Nation announced their development for a housing kind of community. So they have 11 towns with 6,000 units, most of which are going to be rentals, so that's real nice. And then they're, so if you don't know any of the history about, like, the Squamish Nation or Vancouver as a colonial city, basically the Squamish Nation used to have area that was, like, in the Kitsilano community, and they were forcibly moved through buyouts and appropriation, which led the community moving to the North Shore where they are now. Something that I read in, one of my articles was the Squamish councilman, Kelsilim, he called it an illegal eviction. And so I just think it's really rad that the Squamish Nation is kind of reclaiming this land and, like, using it for an economic development, which is shout out to them. But I just think it's really interesting to think about in terms of UNDRIP with the, I forget, what was it, the...
That's going back to, like, Article 32 when it's discussing, like, Indigenous people's rights to develop, like, their own land and everything good and great about that.
Exactly. It's really rad because that's, like, directly doing that. And it's just, like, I'm so proud of them. I'm just so excited for them. And then also something that's really cool that just adds to that whole, like, economic development is that they're taxing it. I forget what exactly they're putting it towards, but... It's going to be a really awesome plan for their nation, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I read this article, I was like, this is the coolest thing. And it looked like so futuristic.
Yeah. We're living in the future.
We're living in the future. It's so cool. I mean, and I think that there are, like, not only is this a great example of, like, unceded lands being developed to benefit the communities, but Squamish is also doing a lot of, like, incredible mm-hmm. things with the policies that they're putting forward. Like, they're really emphasizing, climate-friendly initiatives. They've cut down their car slots to, like, much below the normal amount. And you mentioned, like, the tax mm-hmm. initiatives. Like, they're going to be taxing the developments themselves and benefiting from that money. It's, like, it's incredible. I don't want to get too excited, like, right off the bat, but I think that it is, like, incredible.
It's also interesting. When I was, like, reading up more on this, I just searched up Squamish Nation Development, and there's an article from the Globe and Mail called "What Vancouver City Hall Should Learn from Squamish Nation." It's just like, listen to us, man. We have the answers. Like, Indigenous people are leading the way in the whole, like, what is it called? The climate crisis. Like, we just listen to us. Hashtag land back.
True. All right. So that we've introed this, like, current event that's happening in Vancouver. But as you've already heard, it's pretty futuristic. So we're going to save the rest of this conversation and for the second half of our show, which is on Indigenous futurisms specifically. Before we get to that, though, we're going to hear a track from 2-for-1 called Sage Patch Kid.
See the tallest trees, I believe I'm looking at my living ancestors allowing me to breathe. Although they can't see, its senses are probably far beyond you and me. The plants have a spirit energy, we will feed on the seeds, and if they're not quite edible, we will turn them into beads and wear jewelry. That gives us protection. You could wear my necklace. Think I got it at a powwow in Texas, I can't remember. No wait, it was Denver at the Coliseum. Peace to the Navajo tribe, my native brothers and sisters. I came from Minnesota, a mini Yabakota, and Spirit Lake is the reservation that I'm enrolled in. A family of survivors, I can't believe I'm here and I'm still alive and well, baby, I'm thriving. Had to cut the fried bread, I wanna make some wild rice together later on, and we wild for the night. First, can you teach me how to garden? Can you teach me how our ancestors harvest? Can you show me how to put life back in the yard, in the soil of the earth that we walk? Is it really hard? Please, can you teach me how to garden? Can you teach me how our ancestors harvest? Can you show me how to put life back in the yard, in the soil of the earth that we walk? Is it really hard? I'm like a hippie with a fade. Get lifted in different ways on my path of enlightenment. Would you like it hit or hit me on a different day? Unless you're trying to ride this wave, unless you're trying to make this feel like your favorite holiday. I want to take my shoes off and prance around, laughing in the yard while we dance into some magic sounds. Wagging out, picking raspberries and mulberries and strawberries. Grandma used to send us to the woods to pick choke cherries. It wasn't so scary, really, those were happy days. She sent us down the hill where there was a massive patch of sage. I'm a sage patch kid, you dig? Eating hot dish and it was delish. I almost burnt my lips. She had an apple orchard, it was just too early to pick. We had to wait for fall, but by then we'd be gone. So we sang songs, played with dogs in the lawn or the pasture. Gravel roads kicking up dust and cattails, tall grass in the back. You heard the laughter, that sweet laughter. Now can you teach me how to garden? Can you teach me how our ancestors harvest? Can you show me how to put life back in a yard, in the soil of the earth that we walk? Is it really hard? Please, can you teach me how to garden? Can you teach me how our ancestors harvest? Can you show me how to put life back in a yard, in the soil of the earth that we walk? Is it really hard? Can you teach me the importance of growing my own food? Can you teach me how to put love into everything I do?
And we're back. So that was a part of 2-for-1's Sage Patch Kid. And I promise I didn't pick that song, even though it has my name in it. So now we're getting to my favorite part of the show. We've only done two episodes and I'm already like, this is my favorite part. So obviously we framed it. We keep mentioning it. But our theme this year is Indigenous Futurisms. It deserves the attention. And so this is the part of the show where we're centering Indigenous voices. You're not going to hear stories put in opposition of sort of like colonial oppression or any number of negative themes. We're really focusing on like resurgent efforts, grassroots stuff, artistic stuff, all good stuff. I'm getting excited just thinking about it. And so tonight we're going to carry on our conversation, touch back in on a couple of the topics we've discussed tonight already. So Emily, can you fill us in on any positive things that are going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is not all doom and gloom. And actually, I think things are looking really bright from where I'm sitting. So Inuit people in Canada, I'm being really Inuit specific. I'm sorry, I'm super biased. We're a super tiny population. We get really overlooked even in Indigenous communities. We're like, I think maybe 65,000 strong in Canada. But in that population, we have some communities claiming up to 25% of their population working full-time as artists. So obviously the way that artists are represented, the way communities are represented through art, who has the power over that representation is extremely important. And although we're seeing this huge amount of artists coming out of these communities, like my father included, I grew up with an Inuit artist dad, a lot of people that are in positions of power, critics, curators, gallerists, cultural workers, we're not seeing the same numbers of Inuit reflected in those roles. And so that's how we get articles that, like we discussed earlier this evening, about Inuit are disappearing. They need to be saved. You know, they're impoverished. There's nothing going on here. Why isn't art saving them? And my very simple solution to this problem is just hire Indigenous writers to tell Indigenous stories. Put Indigenous people in charge of their own representation, whether that is in the gallery, in the magazines, on TV. And I think that's not going to happen overnight, and that has to come a lot from capacity building. And I'm really excited that I'm seeing that capacity building happening all the time, and I get to be a part of that capacity building. I'm actually on a grant called the Inuit Futures Grant. So, yeah, so very right to the point of our theme this evening, which is held by Dr. Heather Culiorte at Concordia University, and it empowers Inuit youth to work in different capacities in the arts. So for me, I get to work basically not full-time but part-time as a writer, as a student. So I get to write about art. I get to write about artists. I get to profile artists, many of whom have become my friends, as an Inuit person writing about Inuit people. And I've got other friends working on the same project who are, you know, they're in filmmaking. They're becoming curators. They're being put into these positions of power over representation of the way they themselves and their own communities are being represented in a way that just we have no historical precedence for. And I'm really, really excited because I think it's going to be like huge change on the horizon.
Woo! That's awesome. I think that we can all like attest to this, but Indigenous stories are so much better when they're told from Indigenous perspectives. Like the art, the media, all of it is better when you let us speak for ourselves. That's awesome. And also, Emily's being really modest. She just got a Wicked position working. I don't even know if I'm allowed to talk about it for you. But she's doing great things. And like you said, Inuit art is both awesome and also like often underappreciated or underrepresented. So
I won't get into like specifics of the job because I don't even know how much I can share about it, but I can tell you that my job is going to be working directly with emerging Inuit artists who are beginning their careers and profiling them, writing about them, developing their work with them.
Inuit Indigenous art futures. That's awesome. Well, we're very happy for you.
Thank you.
All right, well, we checked back in on a couple of the things we were talking about tonight. We're super excited to continue the conversation. I'm going to play one more ad. I just really got to, you know, make you want it more.
Hey, Madeline.
Hey, Dora.
What are you listening to?
I'm listening to Kylie V.
Why?
Because they're playing the CITR Music Department fundraiser at the Red Gate on Saturday.
Hey, Alex.
Hi, Dora.
What are you listening to?
Well, I'm listening to Ponytails.
Why?
Because they're really good and they're playing a fundraiser show this weekend on Saturday at Red Gate for our music department.
Hey, Jasper.
Hey, Dora.
What are you listening to?
Oh, I'm listening to Sleepy Gonzalez. Because they're playing the CITR Music Department fundraiser this Saturday at the Red Gate, along with Kylie V and Ponytails.
Are you going to be there?
I'll be there. Are you going to be there?
Yes.
Great.
And we're back. All right, so as we're already oriented now. We're in the future. We're there. We're there. The other day, Billy Ray Belcourt, who everyone knows and loves, and if you don't, go out, go buy a book, read some poetry, feel some things, probably cry. He's going to be teaching at UBC next term. I'm registered in his class. I'm very excited. but he's also he's brilliant. And he's also like actively involved in the academic community here at UBC and at other institutions. And I can only speak from my perspective, but he has a really incredible way of bringing academia into resurgence in a really healthy and exciting way. And he visited one of my classes, and one of Shelby's also in that class. And he mentioned this quote. I don't know if it's his quote, so I might be misquoting him. But he said, it's really important to live and write and think as if we are in the future. I was like, oh, okay. I was like, okay, shut it down right now, okay. But I think that's sort of where we're going to go with this conversation. Keeping with the theme of checking back in and on things we've already talked about, let's open it back up to Squamish. What do you think this means moving forward? Not only just like the practical things that have already happened, but let's get crazy.
I think it's like really interesting because it opens up questions of, or not questions, but it opens up this opportunity for other communities to kind of adopt the same kind of mindset of going forward into the future of like development and like how they can take, I don't know, like just take charge and whatnot.
Hashtag line back.
just to reiterate, that's always it.
And I think like a really nice thing is like, especially when we're talking about like the Squamish development in Kitsilano, and like I highly encourage you Google it and you look at some of this like concept art because it looks rad as heck. Like it's not only like obviously like it at its like core is like, yes, look at that, land back. We love that. But like also it's just aesthetically pleasing and it shows like just how like if you uplift Indigenous people and you allow this to just go freely, you're gonna get some gorgeous and beautiful things, not only just for Indigenous people, but for everybody. It's great.
Yeah, I think it really identifies Indigenous people as key players. And not just as, I think a lot of times people tend to think of Indigenous peoples existing sort of on the peripheries and existing in the past, and having a development in a way that is on their own land, which has been controversial with some of the people that are actually living in Kitsilano. And there's some very ironic, why didn't you consult us complaints? but just, I think like having this really sort of bold assertion of like, we're going to develop here. We're going to do it in our way, on our terms. We're going to make it as sustainable as possible. We're going to, you know, employ our own people. That's really radical. And, you know, that's exciting.
Yeah, also, also with like the city of Vancouver being a city of reconciliation, like they push that. I think this just like makes so much sense that like, I don't know. I'm just glad.
And like Kitsilano's, like, it's a beautiful part of Vancouver. It's like highly desirable. It's at like that gorgeous, picturesque part of like Vancouver. Like if you Google Vancouver, like there's Kitsilano, and to have, you know, this large, like this development isn't small. Like it is a lot of buildings, and to have that highlighted in such an integral part of, you know, the Vancouver area, I think that's going to be really great because it kind of fights back. Again, we talked about that bias of like what Indigenous people are and like what people see us as and how that's like this impoverished thing. This really fights back that stereotype and shows like, hey, no, you know, going into the future, like we have the capability. We've always had the capability to do these wonderful, amazing projects.
Yeah, and then they said with a desirable area. Is, you know what? It's time for us to have some desirable area, right? You know, I think there's, like, this real, like, oh, like, there's almost been this sense of, like, why should they get this land? It's like, why shouldn't?
Exactly.
Why shouldn't we have this prime land?
Right? I'm just, like, scanning over the article right now, and my favorite quote so far is, because the project is on First Nations land, the city has little power to influence the scale and form of the development, nor is the project subject to municipal zoning. Hell yeah! That's so sweet.
Yeah, and it shows the way that the Vancouver, like, city council or whoever it is that's in charge here, they're kind of failing to do what the city needs, like with the Vancouver housing crisis. There's so many people who need housing, and no one's doing anything about it, but Indigenous people here, save ya.
And, like, that's one of the wonderful things, like, about this is, like, it's highlighting that these are rental properties. These are going to be spaces for rent. And it just, it's directly addressing that, like, severe lack of, like, affordable housing in the city. And I really love that. And it's doing it in a, like, again, like, it's going right at, if you look at this development, it's very green. There's a lot of nature incorporated into it. It has a lot of, like, recreational activities to be done that highlights exercise. And it's just, this project is more than just, like, a building. It's really showing, like, you know, what the future could be, not just for Indigenous people, but for everybody if we start moving in that direction that's more sustainable and more accessible and more widely, you know, incorporated into the greater population.
Yeah, I just love it because it is indigenizing this space, you know? And look, like, I am just so proud and just in awe of all of this.
On the subject of like how it looks and indigenizing the space, there's a lot of really great like concept art, not just with like this development, but of Indigenous futurisms, like of reclaiming cities with green space and like with these things in mind. And you know, I would see these like concept arts and I'm like, wow, this is beautiful, like this is really incredible, I'm so, like, I'm happy this exists. But now, like, looking at this development, I'm like, I'm happy this is happening. Like, this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty great.
And I think we even see that, like, in this room, like, all of us are getting, like, really hyped and, like, uplifted about this. Like, it's just like, yes, like, look at that. And, like, in its essence, that's just, like, not only does, like, I know I've highlighted how much, like, this can just speak out to like the greater population, but to Indigenous people it says like, hey, don't let what everybody is, you know, think, any kind of stereotype, don't let that define you. You are so much more than that. You are capable of so much more than like what society has built this image of you. And I love that. Like, this is just one project, and again, it's still in a very early developing stage, but that in its essence just speaks to the louder message of like what, you know, how we need to change that message and how we speak to the futures of Indigenous people rather than treating us as like, you know, a dying culture, something that needs to be, you know, needs to be a dying culture that's like already hopeless. We need to start working on like, you know, where we are now with Indigenous people and where we are moving forward and in doing that.
Take that, Catherine Porter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're all pretty excited about this. Does it make you guys think of anything like else futuristic? Any like where I feel like we're nice and buttered up now to start thinking, and I hope this is, I'm already like spurring some ideas of what other like Indigenous developments could look like, not just like housing and stuff, but I'm like this is a good space to start thinking about like other futuristic stuff. So is there anything on anyone's minds that's coming up?
I mean, a lot like the development of this, you know, the Squamish development in Kitsilano, like it's still early on. Our show is still early on. There's going to be a lot more like futurism that we're going to be talking about in the greater scope of it. But like just like the reclaiming of land in a beautiful way for that kind of integrates us into this, you know, very settler colonial city that's already been, that's kind of been like built to be against us. It's just, it's a really nice and good way to like incorporate in, if you kind of get what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. And then even like futurisms in media too, and Indigenous people producing media that, you know, like for example, Blood Quantum is just out. That's an Indigenous zombie movie. Like, I don't know if that counts as a futurism, but like, I remember I had a colleague once. Yeah, a colleague once who was saying, I don't want to just see like the Indigenous documentary. Where is the Indigenous rom-com? Where's the Indigenous horror film? Where's the Indigenous comedy? But yeah, with the Indigenous rom-com, she's just like, it's called He's Your Cousin.
We were joking last night about doing a dating episode. Okay. So maybe we'll get there. And you definitely should go and see Blood Quantum as well. Mm-hmm. It's really great. There were a lot of actually great films at VIFF, including This Body Remembers When the World Broke Open by Elmaya Tailfeathers. I think it won VIFF.
Oh,
I think
it?
Maybe. Maybe I'm – this is – I could be lying. It should have. Yeah, regardless, it won for me. But yeah, that's – we're rounding out our show. Does anyone have any last thoughts? Anything they're happy, grateful for? Who knows?
Just that, like, this, you know, Indigenous ways is how we're going to secure our futures. And, you know, a lot of, for me as a Mohawk woman, one of our fundamental beliefs is that you do everything in consideration of the past seven generations and your next seven generations. So this whole Squamish development, I think, really has that in mind, and I see that happening. It just falls into wellness, you know, Indigenous wellness and the resurgence of that, and how really, you know, giving it over to Indigenous people is how we're going to be able to really come out of this pitfall of our current climate crisis.
Hell yeah. All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to call it. Mm-hmm. So thank you everyone tonight for speaking, chatting. So yeah, thank you, I guess. Thank you. Our next show, let me just check here. Our next show, we broadcast bi-weekly. So 2 weeks from now, so the 21st of November, we're going to be doing our next show. We talked about it in the last episode, but we're going to change the group of people that we're with every week because we actually have too many people, which is a great problem to have. But we're still going to be talking about Indigenous futurisms, don't you worry. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to the team for chatting. It's been a pleasure. And in honor of our, actually, Emily, I'm going to let you introduce this lovely Inuk artist.
Oh, Reet.
Oh, yeah. Reet?
Oh, Reet, Reet. So tonight we're going to play out a song because it is Inuit Day. Woo. I'm so excited. We're going to play out a song by Reet, who is an artist. I think she's originally from Pang, but she just dropped her album on October 25th. It's called Atataga, which means For My Father, and it's dedicated to her late dad. And we're going to play a song off that album. Album. Kayu, I'm not going to try and pronounce it. I used to know. It's great.
It'll be underneath the episode online.
Yay.
They'll see the word.